And this panel is The Gift of Family Recovery. And we've got six panelists, five distinguished panelists, and one interloper. We are going to share experience, each one of us individually, on what we'll find out as each person shares. We've got, starting on the left, Bill and Bernadette, who we both heard from last night. And if you didn't get an opportunity, you really missed a treat. And then we've got Dave and Polly P. And Linda B., my sponsor's wife. And she'll be filling in for herself and my sponsor. And then you've got me. And I'm the baby of the bunch. I'm the baby of the bunch this whole weekend. So I'm humbled at the opportunity to sit up here with these panelists. And without further ado, I guess we'll, you guys want to just start from that end and work our way back, or start from this end and work our way? I guess I'll start. I'm the baby. Let me start and get out of the way. And again, my name is Ralph White, and I'm an alcoholic. And, okay. Lee, how much we have on this? 80? 75? Okay, panel, we got 75. I'll get out of the way quickly. Yeah, my name is Ralph White. I'm an alcoholic, and I came into recovery. I'm one of six boys, and I ended up coming from a big family, and all of us ended up in the life together. My brothers and I, we drank and we used together. We ended up at my mom's house in 1986 when I got here. You know, all six of us were there, and we almost killed her. I came into recovery on the heels of my younger brother. He was in a treatment center when I got here. And I had come in first. I had bounced out. He came back. He bounced out. Finally, we got it right in 1986. And another brother followed in February of 87. And my baby brother followed in December of 1987. So it ended up, out of the six of us, four of us ended up in recovery. And three of us remain in recovery today. So the gift of family recovery, it's a subject that's real close to me. And especially now. You know, we're coming up into the holiday season. You know, I come from a large family. We didn't have a lot growing up. But we had what we did have. We had a mom who held our family together. I'm from a matriarchal family, and my mother was the head of it. My father was an alcoholic, and he got put out pretty early. So my mom proceeded to raise us by herself. And I can remember coming up, you know, my brothers and I were high achievers, and we always made my mom proud. We were the ones who would show up at church, and we could do, be in the church plays, recite the biblical stuff, do the stuff around Christmas. And my mother was really used to being proud of her sons. It came to a point, after we were grown, mind you, when everything flipped. And holidays were no longer events, you know, at the White House. The boys would come through. We'd give each other a high sign. We'd eat. And then we'd disappear. And I can remember that first Thanksgiving in 1986 when Ron and I were both sober. And we showed back up at my mom's house. And that Christmas in 1986, I'm a next year dad, you know. And for those of you who have parents and were practicing, you know what the next year parent is on Christmas and on birthdays. You're sitting around somewhere, wherever you are, and the family is at home, and you're thinking to yourself, next year I'm going to get that girl something. And I would always think, next year I'm going to get that girl something. And that Christmas in 1986, I was in a recovery home. I was in a treatment center, and I had been there for about 2 months. And I was getting disability. I was too trifling when I was in the life. I had never even pursued any benefits. When I went into treatment, they found out, wow, you qualify for disability. So they were banking my money in the program. And I had some money on the books. And I remember I went out, and I bought a little pink jacket with a gray fur collar. My daughter was 2 years old. And I'm an extravagant guy. I'm an image guy. I'm a what you think of me guy. I like doing stuff over the top, and I like doing stuff big. And I've had a lot of Christmases since then where I've been excessive, and I cry later on, and I hurt, and what were you thinking? You know, I'm that kind of guy. But that Christmas in 1986, when I was in that recovery home, and I felt like my feet were really put on a path that was going somewhere. For some reason, when I came back this fourth time, from the day I came to recovery to this day right now, I've never doubted I would be sober. God took the taste out of my mouth, and he did it real well. And I've never, for a day, thought that I wouldn't be. But that Christmas in 86, a week before I went out, and I bought that pink jacket with a little fur collar. It cost about $40-something dollars. And I imagine looking back now, it probably was not, probably might even look hideous to me, but it looked like a mink stole to me at that time. It looked like a fur coat. And I wrapped it, and I took it, and I didn't take it back. And that Christmas of 87, the following year, my brother was on Skid Row. My baby brother, Ronnie Reggie, and I were sober over a year at the time. And my brother had asked, could he come back and stay at my mom's house? And my mom knew her boys were in recovery, and she said, one of you guys handle this call because I can't. My brother was killing her. But she had three that were sober. She had seen a glimmer of hope. She put me on the phone. This was in November, and it was cold in L.A. I said, you can't come to mom's house. You know, you can come back if you get sober. So a month later, he called on Christmas Eve and said, can I come over to Mama's house for Christmas? And I drove to Skid Row. And none of my brothers, we don't do the street. We don't sleep on the street. And I drove, and a guy jumped in front of my car, and I swerved to avoid him. And I kept looking for my brother, and I drove around the block again. And he jumped out again, and this time I realized that's who it was. I didn't recognize him. And he jumped in my car. I let the windows down. Drove with my head out the window. Got him to my mom's house. My grandmother was still alive that year. And my mother took one look at her baby boy, and she collapsed. And she said, don't let mama, her mother, see him. And we rushed him in the back of the house, and he got in the bathtub for about an hour. And when Rod shares that story, he shares, it's the best Christmas ever. And December 25th, 1987, to this day, he hasn't had a drink. And I thought that boy was beyond God's reach. I'm here to share with you about the transformational power of this power. And if you're sitting out there and you got kids that you gave up on, you got a spouse or a mate that you've given up on, you got somebody that seems like he's voluntarily placed himself beyond God's reach. Here to tell you. Never talked to my brother. Never preached to my brother. I've read chapter 7, and I follow it very closely. I don't have what it takes to not lecture my brother. Talks about no lectures to be endured, no axes to grind, no people to please. When it comes to family, I violate all those. You know, so I didn't try to work with him. What I did was gave him $5 to go to a meeting. I bribed him. And I found a guy at my home group that reminded me of my little brother. And I turned him over to him. And I turned him over to you guys. That's how my brothers and I, that's how we still do recovery. That's how we still do it. Don't try to 12-step. Don't try to sponsor one another. We don't try to do anything except be supportive and be nurturing and turn each other over to this program. You know, so I am really grateful for the gifts of family recovery in my own life. Thank you, guys. Let's hear from Linda right now.
Thank you, Ralph. My name's Linda Bazans, and I'm a grateful member of the Al-Anon Family Group. Boy, that truly is the story of Christmas, isn't it? The gift of family recovery. Well, I have been given more gifts than I should have been. I am so lucky. We have family recovery. I came to Al-Anon 44 years ago to get some tips on how to sober my husband up and basically make him behave. because he wasn't behaving the way I thought he should. And he was sober. So I came to Al-Anon to look good and to get Bob to behave. And I started a journey that I had no intentions of starting and didn't even want. And I look back on it now and I can't imagine my life without it. So I was given the gift to stay and to continue to go to Al-Anon in spite of myself. I love it. My husband's sponsor, who just passed away this summer, his wife was my sponsor for 23 years, and Warren said even a blind sow picks up an acorn once in a while. And that was me. I went to two meetings a week with all the worst intentions. I went to look good, to get Bob to behave, and I thought it was the thing that a new wife should do. And in spite of me, I got recovery. Now, I had to work the steps, and I had to get a sponsor, and I had to do what a sponsor said. And I had to walk through the fire, my own fire. And my husband is still sober, and right now he's in Louisville, and I just talked to him, and he just arrived, and he sends his love and wishes he could be here with all of us. But if I thought it was interesting with Bob, it became a whole lot more interesting with our boys. We have three sons, and when the first one showed signs of, I call it haywiredness, but alcoholism and drug addiction. You know, children who are alcoholic, you can divorce your husband, but you can't divorce your children. They're there. Your heart is connected to them. And when Bill started showing signs of his alcoholism, well, first, you know, denial, and of course it's not that bad and all those things, but when it finally became apparent that he had an issue, I don't know how many years I had in the program, but I had quite a few. I probably had about 19, 20, and I was a newcomer one more time. And I was upset and scared. And children that are involved in alcoholism and drug use are very inconvenient, and they do not make you look good. I want you to know that. And they scare the daylights out of you. And so, anyway, we were fortunate enough that Bill, after some fussing around and some willfulness, he became a member of AA. And this last August, he had 24 years. He's 42 years old. Then our middle son came along. And if I thought Bill was fun, Peter invented that word all over again. He was scarier. He was more outside of the law, and he was, it was more scary. And he sobered up when he was 19. I can't tell the story because I can tell it to you in private, but I can't tell it to you from the podium because it's just right here. And that's gratitude is right there. And anyway, Peter, last January, had 20 years. And he just turned 40 about a week or two ago. Okay, then we have one more child. And I'm thinking, when I saw the signs, No, not three out of three. Come on. No, it can't be. And I mean, I was just, I don't know if I was shaking my fist at God, but I was real close. How can I have to go through this again? How can this happen to me? It wasn't happening to me. It was happening to my beautiful child. And Daniel was literally thrown off of his donkey on the way to Damascus. I would not allow another Bazan's child out on the road driving. So Dan did not have a driver's license. But he was on a drug run on his bicycle, and he got hit by a van and ended up in a coma in the hospital, and it was a hit and run. And after that, and then into neurology, we found out there were all sorts of substances in our young child's body that we had no idea about. And we put him actually in the psych ward for 3 days until an opening was available for him at Hazelden. And last May, Daniel had 13 years. So as you can see, I've been well gifted, and I've been so blessed. And I am so grateful. And I go to Al-Anon today because I'm a better person because I go to Al-Anon, not because of the stories I just told you. Today's our 44th wedding anniversary. And I started thinking today, you know, about, I guess, what I wanted to say up here. And I started thinking about the sermon that the priest did at our wedding. And one of the things he said was, you fell in love with each other for who you are. Don't try to change that. Don't diminish the wonder. And I want you to know I spent years trying to change my husband. And I would have diminished what we had. But thank goodness he's a strong man and he does not change easily. And he certainly does not change on cue. I want you to know that. And so I was not successful in changing Bob, and I am so grateful today that I was not. I think one of the things that we did for each other to keep our relationship alive was we dated. We, for years, were arguing about bills and money and kids and the kids' issues and his going to too many meetings and all the little things that, you know, I think you argue about. And we just decided to start dating, and we dated one night a week where we had each other's undivided attention. And it was really, I think it was so vital in keeping our marriage alive and keeping us healthy and well. And I tell people if they do it today, we had the luxury of no cell phones. And you'd have to change the rules a little bit because being alone is a lot harder nowadays. But I think it's important. And I think that's one of the things that kept us alive. And then the bottom line of what kept us alive was the program. If we didn't have each other, if we didn't have our own programs to focus on the things that we did wrong, to focus on our issues and not to get into each other's, because you know it's so much easier to take someone else's inventory, and it is absolutely futile. And thank God that we had God alive in our marriage and that we had people like you who gave us advice and told us what to do and gave us ideas of how to maintain what we had. And I am truly blessed, and I thank you.
My name is Polly Pistol, and I'm an alcoholic. And I was just listening to Ralph and Linda, and I just, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, you know, how do you, and, you know, 10 or 12 minutes talk about the gifts of sobriety. And so I'm just going to kind of highlight and just start off with getting sober started off with, you know, we're talking about Christmas, about me being able to show up for Christmas and not be too drunk to open the packages or try to get the kids to, you know, go back to bed and all of the stuff that Christmas represented for so many years because of my alcoholism. And the gift of sobriety is Dave. I met Dave in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I look at our lives today, and Dave and I have been able to be married 31 years, and he's the love of my life. And I met him here. And if I hadn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have my Dave. And Dave and I get to share this road together. I mean, we love it. We both love Alcoholics Anonymous. We do things differently because we're two different kind of people. But I just, you know, I can't imagine what my life would be like if I didn't live with somebody who was in recovery. I just can't imagine what that would look like. But I don't have to imagine it because we get to share it. My youngest son got sober when he was 21 years old. And on January the 3rd, he'll be 28 years sober. And James was a really bright kid. He was one of those kids that was going to high school and He found drugs when he was 14, and he was bright, and he looked like he had a future that was just, you know, to die for. And lo and behold, before it was over, he had dropped out of college and just done all the things we do behind alcohol when the disease of alcoholism gets a hold of us. And he got sober. And one of the things that I always like to say is we never know. You know, we never know who's watching. And we may be the only big book anybody ever reads. But probably the greatest gift that I get, or one of the greatest, I've got so many. One of the greatest gifts I get to hear is when my son shares his AA talk, and he said, I knew AA worked because I saw what it did for my mom. And it absolutely transformed her from the person she was to the person she is today. And what happened for me was that I was hardly sober myself. I was 6.5 years sober, and he called and he said that he wanted what I had. My oldest son has other problems, but he's also an alcoholic. And Russ didn't stop drinking until 2 years ago, Halloween, October the 31st. So if you're hanging around wondering, you know, just don't give up 5 minutes before the miracle, because it can happen, the gifts of sobriety. We had what looked like, because Russ had stopped trying to kill himself, because that was his thing. He was constantly trying to hurt himself, and he had stopped that, and things looked pretty good, and James was sober, and they were both married. We had 5 grandchildren. I mean, it looked like, you know, here was the story. Here was the recovery story, and we had these fabulous grandchildren. Our first grandchild was born deaf, and, you know, I was talk about fist at God. I mean, like, how can that happen? And find out today that that's one of the greatest gifts of all, is because I didn't even know the things that look so bad that can turn out to be the greatest gifts. Well, little by little, things started falling apart. First, my oldest son and his wife get a divorce. And I just, you know, I was just so devastated by that. And now James and his wife are in the process of getting a divorce. And I'm like, you know, I like the other story better. I like the story where everybody's doing good and things are great. And that's not really what's happening right now. But I was thinking about last Christmas. And I don't know. I don't know what this Christmas is going to bring. But last Christmas, Russ lives in California, and James lives in Chicago, and Dave and I were living in Washington State. So I called up Russ, and I said, we're going to come to California for Christmas. Because I just, you know, I just wanted to be there for Christmas for him. And then James called on the phone, and he says, well, I'm coming too. And he and his wife were separated. And so that Christmas, I had my two sons and Dave and I and another friend, we were at a friend's house for Christmas. And my oldest son sat there at the Christmas table, and he said, for his gratitude, he says, this is the best Christmas I've ever had. And what happened in our lives is that my oldest son had always been so jealous of his brother. Because, you know, we all have different gifts. And James was just kind of one of these people that just kind of had the Midas touch. Whatever he touched turned to gold. And Russ struggled and struggled and struggled financially. So he thought James had everything good, and that was, you know, and he was just jealous. And he used to say, well, if you got enough money, it'll solve everything. And what happened was, is he watched James's situation with his divorce, of which he has to this day not been with his daughter in 22 months. And it's tragic. It's just tragic. And Russ said, I thought all along that money was the problem. He says, but I can't imagine what it would be like if I couldn't see my girls. And so what happened was is a healing took place between my two sons that I never believed was possible because they had never gotten along, and as they got older, it got worse. So I think that I want to say that probably in the middle of all the stuff that looks so bad, it's the silver lining that is so good. And it's fabulous because now my son Rush would not call me on the telephone. And it wasn't that he didn't love me or anything like that. He would just say, I don't have anything to say. And the self-worth that Russ has, I believed him. He just didn't have anything to say. It wasn't about me. But what happens is he calls me today several times a week because he wants to know how his brother is. That's his excuse now for calling, to find out how his brother is. So what happens is the gifts go on. They're just not the way I thought they were going to be. And I don't know where God's going to take all this. All I know is that I have a beautiful relationship with my sons. And I have a so-so relationship with my daughter-in-laws, ex-daughter-in-laws, one of them's ex. And I have a great relationship with my grandchildren. And I get to go see my deaf grandson that looked like such a tragedy. Is at RIT, Rochester Institute of Technology. You don't get in there, you know, if you're not at least got something going on. And so there he is, and here he's deaf. And I know that the reason that he has got the kind of life that he has as a deaf kid is because his parents were sober. So another gift of sobriety. And, you know, and the gifts go on. It's just, I feel like that life has been an absolute blessing. And I want to say one more thing about Al-Anon, because we were in this fabulous Al-Anon meeting. And I want to say that I am also a member of Al-Anon. And I know today I would not be sober if it were not for Al-Anon. Because these two sons of mine, I didn't think I could. I was in too much pain. I was absolutely in too much pain. And it appeared to me that people in AA just had a really hard time bumping up against that kind of pain. And what happened is I went to Al-Anon, and these women put their arms around me, and they said, of course you feel the way you do. You're a mom. But what we're going to do is we're going to show you how to love your sons without it killing you. And I know today that I've got 34 years of sobriety, and I have that 34 years because I've been an active member in Al-Anon, because I don't believe I could have been sober. Something would have had to give. I was in so much pain. So I truly believe, I'm one of the people that believes, that family recovery can be a lot better if, for me, as an alcoholic person, by adding Al-Anon to it. So, thanks.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Dave. I know I don't look like it, but I'm an alcoholic. And that was a favorite line of a dear friend of mine, and I say that to keep his memory alive. His name was Bob Cargill. He's dead. I can give his last name. I came, well, first of all, you know, the fundamental thing about my relationship with my wife, Polly, and within my family is that I am not the best judge of that. If you want to know what it is really, really like at our house, let me refer you to Susie and Carol and Leslie and Jan. These are newcomer AA women that came to live with us in our house, not spend a week. They lived there. Susie and Carol were there about a year and a half each, and Jan was there about 8 or 9 months. And there's a great story behind that I don't have time to tell you. But they're the ones to ask. Polly and I live out loud. You know, everybody around. It's not hard to find somebody in AA who knows one or the other of us. Usually both of us, and we don't try to hide anything. You either have to be some kind of natural born fool, or you have to be wildly optimistic to move newcomers into your house that are members of your home group. that takes raw courage, but when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had never ever been in any kind of family that today I would call healthy. I wouldn't call my family with my family of origin sick. I would just, you know, but my parents were just, nobody ever seemed to really put anything into their lives. So they didn't have anything to put into mine. I'm not angry about that or anything. I am absolutely flabbergasted at how beautiful my life has turned out to be. I would change nothing about my life. I would not change my parents or anything else. But when I got here, I didn't know anything about how to have a family, what a family meant. You know, we were incredibly poor. And when you live in abject poverty, you know, my response was, what do you mean share? Hell, there's already not enough to go around. I'm not sharing nothing. And that's just the attitude you have. When you have to live under those conditions, you know nothing of generosity. You know, my parents didn't have any friends. Nobody ever came over to see them, and they never went over to see anybody else. You know, we were just closed in, and nothing escaped. And unless the radio was on and my parents were listening to Jack Benny or some of those people, there wasn't any noise in our house. Nobody said anything. There was no invitation to, you know, talk about anything. You know, I was never encouraged to be anything more than just like them. And I don't hold that against them at all, you know. I mean, did they love me? Yeah, they did, you know, in their own way. But, you know, if you don't have it, you can't give away what you don't have. You just can't. And so I had to always figure things out on my own. Well, figuring things out was not hard when you have a keen, razor-sharp alcoholic mind like I have. I understand they don't talk about keen, razor sharp alcoholic minds in Al-Anon meetings. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous honestly nearly dead from the disease of alcoholism, and I came in with my life a total failure. I knew it that whatever good times I may have once had that I couldn't even remember, that was all. There was not going, that's as good as it's ever going to be, and it's just going to do what it's been doing for some time now, which is just gradually get worse, inch by inch, moment by moment, worse and worse. So I came into Alcoholics Anonymous feeling that way. I was angry. I was way too sensitive. You know, just the brutality of untreated alcoholic emotions will just drive you crazy. They're just brutal. And I came in here and I slowly began to have things go on. I have Polly's my fourth wife. You can tell how good I was at figuring things out. And we came in here, we knew nothing, but we found out that Alcoholics Anonymous, as it says in our book, we were designed for living. You know, this program is a design for living. And I have to somehow live on this earth. And I was beginning to get happier and happier about living. And in a meeting of AA in Hearst, Texas, in October of 1977, little basement of a little Methodist church, I went to an AA meeting. There were about six or eight people there, and Polly was one of them. And we were friends for 3 years, just that, friends. No hanky-panky, no nothing, just good friends. We'd meet for coffee. We would have food now and then, lunch. But neither one of her two boys seemed to be all that enthusiastic about me. My two children were scattered to the winds. My son died in 2002. He came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and in a health screening, they found out he was HIV positive. And 9 years later, after spending 9 years totally asymptomatic, he found out that it had spread. He had a very aggressive form of lung cancer, and he died. Almost, it seemed like it was almost overnight. But slowly, by putting the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and for that matter, Al-Anon, to work in my life, I gradually, slowly learned not to be something that I thought I could never be, which is a good father. I didn't think I would ever qualify for being a family. You know, Polly's, in all three of my first marriages, I had stepchildren. They all hated me, and that was an appropriate way to feel, for them to feel about me. I didn't know anything about kids, and I treated them badly. You know, I was raised in a family where, you know, you don't talk back to your parents. You get backhanded right out of your high chair if you talk back to your parents. And that's the kind of stuff I had in my head. So none of my attempts at being in a family had ever been anywhere close to succeeding or being. There was no generosity, no kindness, no love, no nothing. And I got hooked up with Polly, and I got hooked up with AA. And that's where I was taught the beauty of a family. I have two stepsons. They are both really favorite people of mine. In fact, I talked to one last night in California. I talk to the other one fairly often, but not as often as his mother. You know, I don't want to say he's a mama's boy, because that's not what he is, but he and Polly have an unbelievably close relationship, you know. She told me the other day that James had called and said, I forgot to call you yesterday. Well, they talk every day. Yeah. That's what AA has done. That's not anything, you know, we don't know how to do that. That's what AA has done. I have nothing to tell you then, except that if you put the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to work in your life, if you put the principles to work in your life, you know, if you put honesty, you know, this is a. I have guys that I sponsor, and they want to tell me about what their wife did and this and that. I said, I don't care what she did. I'm not interested in what your wife did. I'm not her sponsor. I'm yours. I'm interested in what you do. I want you to be the very best guy you can be, and your wife is going to do whatever she does, and she doesn't care what you think she ought to do either. You know? Nor should she. You know, she should be working on being the very best. You seem to think that, you know, that a lot of us seem to think that, you know, that the whole object in male-female relationships are in just marital relationships. You know, I don't even need to confine it to male, female, any kind of relationship. The big trick is to find the right person, you know, to find your soulmate. And I think that's just rubbish. The trick is not to find the right person. The trick is to be the right person. Alcoholics Anonymous will show you how to be the right person. If you're not the right person and your little miss or Mr. Wonderful comes along and sits down on the log beside you, if you're not the right person, they're not going to stay. You know, if you don't have, if you want to, my opinion, if you want a really good, warm, lasting relationship that will make your heart glow and sing, you have to have the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We didn't invent these principles. They've been around for a long, long time. We've been told by every form of spirituality that I know of to live by these principles, and Alcoholics Anonymous has adopted them. You know, and what are they? Honesty is a big one. Commitment. You know, do what you say you're going to do. Kindness, generosity, compassion. You know, those are the ones. You know, I have a lady that I used to work with, or that used to be in AA with me in Bellingham, Washington, and she came to business meetings, and she was unbelievably opinionated and had a scratchy personality, and just, you know, I didn't like her. She was a control freak. And every time we had a business meeting, she and I would lock horns. And then one day I had a moment of AA clarity come into my head. And I thought, you know, I'm not going to spend the rest of my life in a home group where I have an adversarial relationship with a good member of this group. It's always here, and it always shows up for business meetings and blah, blah, blah. I'm not gonna do it. I don't care what it takes or how long it takes or what I have to do. I'm gonna make a friend out of her. She and I are gonna be friends. And that's exactly what I did, and it didn't take a long time. Now she calls me on the phone just to say hello. So put AA in your relationship, and you're good to go. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Hi, my name is Bernadette. I'm a very grateful member of the Worldwide Fellowship of Al-Anon and Alateen Family Groups. Hi, it's good to be here. I want to read this little bit first. I'm a big little reader of things. I want to read this little bit. Thank you, Jack. He always reminds me. The purpose of life is not to be happy. The purpose of life is to matter, to be productive, to have it make some difference that I have lived it all. So that's what happiness was. I thought happiness was, I don't know what I thought it was. And I don't know when I realized what it was. It sort of came. It just came with the program and everything else. But I do remember the year before Bill got sober, the Christmas before that April. And he came in at 2 in the morning with a tree. Everything was broken off it, and he put up some stuff and you know, but yeah, our children were little. They didn't care. If we smiled and we laughed, so I just cut down the tree and it was fine. I really don't remember what Bill did, but that was a pretty horrific Christmas. The following Christmas, we were leaving for Nashville the day after Christmas because Bill had gotten a job. He was sober, and our children were 5 and under. We had 5 children. And we had Christmas at my mother's house, which was right upstairs from where we downstairs from where we lived. And it was lovely, and we had a wonderful Christmas. We fixed a tree, and a lot of things hadn't changed, but our Christmas changed because we were there and because we were leaving to go to Nashville, to Al-Anon and Alateen, which we knew was strong there. We had been there. So that made our Christmas wonderful, and we were all very happy when we left. I remember at that time, that first year, packing up the kids when holidays came. We would go together. We would pack up the children. We would go to church. We would go to our in-laws. We would go to my mother's. And then we would stay and do whatever we had to do. So that made it a happy time for us. I love family. Then we moved to Nashville, and Christmas became a good thing. It became a very good thing. Christmas means a lot to us, to me anyway. I can't speak for everyone. And Bill and I would shop together. This was very new for me. Shop together. Not anymore. We do not shop together anymore. I shop by myself. We bought their presents together. That's not a dig. It's just the truth, you know. You're not going to come with me and buy a dress.
My turn is next.
Okay. And I love to learn to bake again. I always baked when I was younger with my mother, and I learned to bake again. And then after a few years, we left and came to New York, back to New York. And we both got very active in the problems, as we did in Nashville, as we did in Ohio. But there we had this big house. We had four more children. So we had 9 children, and it was a joy to have Christmas. I just loved it. It was just wonderful. Everything was all over the place, and Daddy was putting the bikes together in the middle of Christmas Eve and things like that. And it was more, really, than I could have ever dreamed of, really, living in Nashville. And we also packed the kids up, went to church, didn't have any family. But we went to Al-Anon meetings or AA meetings or went to families there in Nashville. And then we lived in a big house in Rye, New York. And this is what I'm saying, we did a lot of stuff together and had all these other children. And it came to be that nobody had places to go on New Year's Eve. We used to have big family parties because I come from a very large family. And they weren't coming anymore. So we decided to open it to AA and Al-Anon. And we would have 200 to 300 people. We had a great, big, wonderful house. And it was a big white elephant, really, but it was a wonderful house. And we would have 200 to 300 people and have a wonderful Christmas. And so, in my own way, I feel like I might have made a difference in my family and might have made a difference to the groups in Al-Anon. We still meet people. And now I have two of my children that are in the program, and they have talked about these parties in Rye, New York. And someone would come up to them and say, "Was your mom and dad Bernadette and Bill?" You know, I mean, this is really exciting to hear this happen to them. And they remember a lot of that. Life is very different now, and I'm very grateful. I'm so happy when I'm at an AA Al-Anon convention. It really makes me bloom. Thank you.
Thank you, Bernadette. I'll be nice. My name is Bill, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
And I'm a very, very grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That has given me a life beyond my comprehension. You know, it's really wonderful to sit here and listen to the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and each one's life. I mean, I'm in the movie business, and I couldn't write movies like this, you know. It is unbelievable, you know, from you, Walter, that Christmas story, you know. And how this program is, as you said, Dave, without this program, we wouldn't have any of this. We wouldn't be the kind of people that we are, you know. And the kind of people that we were, that I was, I pray to God I don't even come close to it anymore, you know. Every aspect of my life back then was me, me, you know. And today it's different. So different that it's hard to describe. But anyway, we do shop together once in a while. I mean, when I run out of underwear, I go with you and you pick it out, stuff like that. But it is different because, well, our children have grown up. And, you know, so we don't go shopping for the toys and the games and all of that anymore, you know. By the way, when Bernadette mentioned that tree that we had brought home at 2 o'clock in the morning. Isn't it amazing how we can laugh like crazy about the worst things that happened in our lives, you know? I do remember, and I was probably in and out of a blackout, but it was Christmas Eve, and I was staggering out of a bar in New York and heading for home, and I suddenly realized it was Christmas Eve, and we had no tree, you know? And So I took the train and I got off, and as I was walking along this avenue, there was an apartment house with a lovely tree in the lobby. Now, it didn't have a for sale sign on it, but I figured they got enough use out of it already, right? So I went, there was nobody around. I walked in, I unplugged it, and I dragged it home. And by the time I got it home, half the ornaments were broken and some of the lights and whatnot, and I staggered that into the basement and lit it. So there were two things lit, the tree and me. I mean, I laugh, but that's what happened to me. That's the kind of person I became. I had a wife and five kids and didn't give a damn, really. And I thought I was doing a big thing that Christmas Eve, getting them a tree. How sick can you get? You can get a lot sicker than that, too, but that's, you know. And then, as Bernadette described, things began to change as I began to get sober. And as Bernadette began to work her Al-Anon program. And I hated Al-Anon in the beginning. I hated it. You know, I thought that, you know, all the Al-Anons got together in the back room and talked about us drunks and shared, you know, information. And my sponsor said, what the hell do you think she's going to find out about you that she doesn't ordinarily know? You know? And I never forget that. In fact, I wrote that as a scene in When Love Is Not Enough. But I didn't know about Al-Anon. And it took me a while to come to appreciate Al-Anon. And you know when I came to appreciate it? As I was at a men's meeting one night in Westchester County. And it was all men. And I don't go to those kind of men's meetings anymore, but it was the kind of men's meeting where, you know, they used, you know, terrible language and stuff like that, and knocking the women and all, and knocking Al-Anon. And I couldn't understand why they were knocking Al-Anon when my life with my wife was getting better. You know? Didn't make no sense to me. So I stopped going there, and I tried to learn more about Al-Anon. Then when Bernard introduced me to Lois, it just, the whole understanding just began to, you know, exploded in my life. But anyway, the family afterwards, what happened to me is I became a father. I had children, but I wasn't a father. In sobriety, I became a father. I began to do what other fathers did. And by doing it, I came to realize, you know, what a father should do. For example, I became an assistant manager of my son's Babe Ruth League team. And then when my other son came up, I became the manager, and I saw a manager of Babe Ruth League team. I began to go to father-daughter dinners at the high school when my daughters went to high school. I got involved in, I became a judge in the high school debate club and judging debates. Got involved in watching girls play volleyball. So it wasn't just all one-sided, although Bernadette often says it. Well, we had more boys, so I was involved in more boys' activities, you know. We had six boys and three girls, you know. And, oh, I also, thank you, and I also coached my wife's softball team. Now, that takes a lot of courage, you know, because there was one game where the score was tied, bottom of the seventh inning, and we had three ladies on base. We were losing by one run. We needed two to win. And my wife was coming up to bat. And I pinched hit for her. Isn't that a true story? Yeah. She pretended to be angry, but she told me later at home that she was relieved. So a pinch hitter hit her. We won the game. A pinch hitter hit a base hit, and we won the game. But in other words, in many ways, life became wonderful as a family, the family afterwards, you know. And I became close to my children and to my wife. I want to tell just one story to give you an example of that. As Bernard said last night and again this morning, that we would take our children with us to open AA meetings. If I was speaking or celebrating an anniversary, and because we wanted our children to come to understand about the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction, you know. We didn't want them to be ignorant of that because the way things were going as they grow up, you know, and the way they are now, it's incredible how you can raise children. And so they, you know, they were fully aware of my being an alcoholic and their mother being an alcoholic. So this is now 1976, and I got invited to participate in a project that was going to take place in Washington, D.C. The National Council on Alcoholism and CBS got together to put on a program called Operation Understanding. They felt if they could get people from fairly well-known people from all walks of life to stand up, this had nothing to do with AA now, so it had nothing to do with anonymity, but to stand up and tell the world that they were recovered alcoholics, it could help with the terrible stigma of alcoholism. The whole idea was to try to lessen the stigma. So the president at that time was a friend of mine, and he invited me because I was in the process of doing My Name is Bill W., the movie. And we all met in Washington, D.C., and but when I got invited and told my wife about it, she was a bit hesitant, to be honest, and she'll admit that. She thought, well, how would the children react? Would they be embarrassed? You know, would we be embarrassing our children if, you know, my picture appeared in a paper and it was a story about all of us and that I was an alcoholic? You know, that's. So I said, well, let's ask them. So we sat down around the dining room table. Our nine children, our oldest was then around 19, and the youngest was around 6. And I told them about my invitation to participate in this, where I would be telling the world that I was a recovered alcoholic. How would you feel about that? I was overwhelmed at their immediate response. They said, well, what's the problem? And my oldest son said, Dad, I mean, everybody knows you as a terrific, you know, Babe Ruth League coach and coaching Little League and coaching Mama's softball team. And the girl said, Dad, I mean, you're always at the, you know, father and son do dinners in high school, you're the debate coach and all that. I mean, we don't care. I mean, wouldn't that help people if they found out that a man like you, who's sober and doing all this stuff, was an alcoholic? Wouldn't it help people? That's how our children responded. That's the family after. That's the family in recovery. That's the family that has come to understand that something bad has happened, but now it's good, and it could be passed on to others. And Bernard and I cried. We were so overwhelmed by our children and their understanding. And that's really, to me, what it's all about, because as Dave said, and Paul, and as we all know, and that's what this conference is so much about, is it's a family disease. It affects every aspect of our lives and everyone in the family. And when the alcoholic recovers and the spouse recovers, the family recovers. And it's just wonderful when you see that. And what a privilege it is to sit up here with these other wonderful people, including my lovely wife Bernadette, and to share and to talk about that. It's incredible. Thank you very much.
This has been, in my mind, being a father, one of the greatest gatherings we've had. We only had 5 children. Well, you know, she was slow. But all of you are perfect examples of what God's done. And that means that it can happen to anybody. These are not special people that were picked out. It'll happen to you if you turn to love, get out of judgment, and try to work with others. I want to thank you all. Why don't we close with the Lord's Prayer?